Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. As we approach the launch of Connecticut's paid leave program, which will offer Connecticut workers the opportunity to take time to attend to personal and family health needs without worrying about lost income, we're going to check in with the CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Authority to help employers and employees better understand the program. Next, have you heard that U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal just introduced legislation to promote advanced care planning and end-of-life care to ensure patients get the care they want and that's right for them? To help frame that proposed new national effort, we're going to bring in the CEO of Compassion and Choices, the nation's largest and oldest end-of-life care advocacy organization, to discuss how the proposed bill will help empower everyone to chart their end-of-life journey. And we'll close with a candid conversation featuring a CEO that oversees 32 Planet Fitness locations across Connecticut. As the state continues to navigate the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, and with threats of statewide shutdowns in surrounding states, there's been recent attention on the potential for stronger restrictions. So we're going to hear from the source about why this may be such an unhealthy move. We're going to be right back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Hey, there's a lot to know about vaping, and to best inform yourself and protect your child, get the facts concerning the signs, symptoms, dangers, and what is behind this epidemic. You can play a significant role in protecting your child from the dangers of vaping and nicotine dependence. The American Lung Association wants you to be able to maintain an open line of communication with your kid and use the tips and suggestions they offer in a new online resource as a framework for having a productive conversation. To access or download that guide, just go to lung.org. Well, you may have received notification from your employer that a deduction is going to start being taken from your paycheck in January, or you've been hearing about folks talking about this Connecticut paid leave program. And as we approach the launch of that program in January, which is going to offer Connecticut workers the opportunity to take time to attend to personal and family health needs without worrying about lost income, we're so happy to welcome the CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Act, Andrea Barton Reeves. Andrea, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
So let's finish up a little bit of the boilerplate that people need to know about this new Connecticut paid leave program. I know a lot of folks probably have questions about the program. We're going to go through some of the most frequently asked questions, but this really has impact on employers, small businesses, sole proprietors. What more in terms of the introduction of this Leave Act do we need to know?
Well, it was passed into law in July of 2019, and since we had quite a year in 2020, I can certainly understand how it would have fallen off the radar of many employers and employees as well. But the plan was always to implement paid leave in two phases, which is very common, and it's done in the 9 other states that have it. This is the way in which paid leave is implemented, where contributions are collected in the first year and then benefits are made available in the second year. So we're coming up on the contribution year in 2021. And then in 2022, people will be able to access those benefits for a number of qualifying reasons, which includes creating or expanding your family, your own serious health condition, that of a family member, and also for those who are victims of domestic violence, which is not common in other states, but it's particular to our state.
Very good. Well, as we air this, the last Sunday of the year, we're coming up on a key deadline, right?
We are. So we are coming up on the deadline of December 31st, where we're asking all employers to register, keeping in mind that the statute, the law applies to employers of one employee or more. So we know this is very new for employers who have not had any familiarity with paid leave or family medical leave in general before now. The current laws apply to employers that either have 50 or more employees for federal FMLA or for 75 or more for state family and medical leave. So it's an entirely new world for small employers. So one of the reasons we're asking for registration is so that we at the Paid Leave Authority know that you as an employer know that that obligation for withholding begins, and also so that we can have a better sense of who you are, because we'd like to begin to provide you with support and education in the coming year so that you're not alone as you're trying to administer the program.
Mm-hmm. And what about solo proprietors or self-employed people?
So those that are sole proprietors and self-employed can opt into the program at any time. They are not required to participate. If a sole proprietor has employees, then withholding for those employees is required, but the sole proprietor themselves can choose to opt in at any time. But if they choose to, the law requires that they remain in the program for 3 years.
Very good. So why do employers need to register? Is that the only way that will create the permanent record that carries through the various channels and agencies that have to, administer this?
Yes, so that's one of the reasons why. The second is that through our website, ctpaidleave.org, that's the one place where everything essentially happens for paid leave. So it's the place where now employees, employers, sole proprietors, self-employed, third-party administrators can get information about the program itself. It's also the place where you register, because eventually when payments will be submitted and the first round is due the end of April, that's the way in which you will submit your payments. Some folks have said to us, I don't understand why you need a different system. We already have something for unemployment insurance. We already have something for the Department of Revenue Services, for our taxes. Why do we need to get a different place? And the reason is that is true. Those agencies do exist for the collection of taxes. But we have a separate trust fund that's associated with that collection. So in order for us to be able to properly account for those monies, we collect them separately. Also, the Department of Revenue Services is well ahead of us in developing their collection service. And at some point, we hope those two will come together. But right now, that wasn't something that we were able to do. So we were in partnership with them in different ways. But for the purposes of collection, we're doing it separately so that we can make sure that money is segregated and goes directly into the trust fund.
So you are seeing a situation where this might change or modify, in the relatively short term?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that we're in a process where we will be able to share more information with the Department of Revenue Services as a way of providing a check and balance for ourselves and for employers. So when employers collect the 0.5% and they send it to us as a paid leave authority, they'll also be providing us with wage information. How much is everyone making, or what's the aggregate amount, so that we can do the math. If we are wrong, then we want to be able to go back to the Department of Revenue Services or to the Department of Labor to double check our numbers. And if we feel, based on the numbers that have been provided by an employer, that something might not quite be matching, then we want to make sure that we have different ways in which we can communicate with those agencies that have sort of a longer standing record of wages and income. Hmm. It's just so that it's a way for us to treat everyone fairly. We don't want to go back to an employer and say, oh, you didn't pay enough, when we have another way of being able to make sure that we're right about that.
Yeah.
And that way that we can have an appropriate, informed dialogue with employers and not accuse them of anything.
And this is in part because you're a relatively new and first of its kind office or department, if you will, in the structure of state government, right?
We are. So we are a quasi-governmental agency, meaning that we were created by statute for a sole purpose that was defined by legislation. but not a full state agency in the sense of the ones that I've mentioned, let's say the Department of Revenue Services or Department of Labor. Where a quasi-state agency is like the lottery or the airport authority, that's sort of where, you know, where we are in that constellation of state agencies.
Okay. And that is Connecticut Paid Leave Act. We're talking with Andrea Barton Reeves. She's CEO of this quasi-public agency, which has been working for months to ramp up, but the rubber, so to speak, will be hitting the road as the deadlines at the end of December begin to take effect. Andrea, what do employees need to know? Because a lot of them, you know, although they may have received notification or warnings or got some word of mouth input, they're going to start seeing a little incremental piece of their pay being attributed to this deduction, right?
Yes, they will. I think the important thing for employees to know is that the money goes into a trust fund. We've heard questions about security and where does the money go. So it doesn't go into the state's general fund, so it's secure from that perspective. And it can't be used for any other purpose except for the administration of the fund and paid leave and to pay benefits. They should also know that once they qualify, they will be able to pay for the benefits. And depending on their wage level, some employees may qualify for up to 95% of wage replacement when they do have to go out to take leave for the reasons that I noted earlier. So if you're having a baby or you have serious health condition, you won't have to worry about something coming in the door so that you can keep your lights on and take care of your kids, which is a real scenario for many, many of the workforce, many people in the workforce in this state.
Okay. What do when do employers submit their payroll contributions?
They submit them on the last day of the month following the end of the quarter. So the first payment would be due on April 30th. And we've heard employers loud and clear when they've said to us, please don't create yet another deadline for us to meet to submit anything else to the state. And they'd rather pay at the same time that they pay their payroll taxes and any other taxes that are due to the state. So that's why our payment cadence is the same as the ones that are already in existence.
And what happens if a business doesn't withhold the correct amount from employees or doesn't do the withholding?
Well, we'd like to work with employers in this first quarter. We know it's challenging, and for that reason, we've worked with the Department of Labor so that in the instances where employers either don't withhold or don't withhold enough, there are some provisions for catch-up, but they're really those provisions are really in place to just help employers kind of get their process rolling. It's not for those that decide that they have an objection to the statute itself and are not participating. But we really want to work with all the employers to say, we understand it's difficult. We know we're in unprecedented times. Just let's try to work together. And if that approach doesn't work, then the statute does allow us to impose penalties, but it's really not the place that we're trying to go initially at all.
Yes, starting and following through with many, many kind words and collaboration before the actual rule book comes out, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Excellent. Well, what wages are subject to employee contributions?
The definition of wages is pretty broad, so it does include our regular paychecks, commissions and bonuses and the like, but there is a cap on the amount of money from which the deductions are taken, and that is the Social Security wage cap, and that's right now $142,880. So if you make more than that, those funds or that income above that level is not subject to any further withholding, but it is pretty broad in terms of the definition of wages.
Okay. And as is the case with so many people, especially now since the job landscape has changed so much and folks are taking on additional responsibilities or cobbling together multiple jobs to make one full-time income, if an employee works for more than one employer, do the employers need to coordinate to decide who deducts the contributions?
No, they don't. So the one half of 1% will come from each job. And then we at the Paid Leave Authority will then determine what that person's contribution is and when they've capped it. So if we see that a person's working for multiple employers, which many people do, then we'll be able to manage that from our end with respect to the contribution. But I'm glad that you asked this question, because the statute really is very favorable to those who work multiple jobs, in that the amount of money that you need to earn in order to qualify for benefits is fairly low. It's $2,325 within 15 months of the time that you need to apply for leave. And also, if you currently work for an employer, but you don't work enough hours, or you don't have enough time with them, you will never qualify for family medical leave. If now you have to work for an employer for a whole year, and you have to work 1,000 hours to get family medical leave eligibility with an employer. If you're working multiple jobs, it's unlikely that you'll meet that threshold with any one employer. So now with this statute, you will most likely meet that threshold very soon, because you don't have that hours worked requirement anymore. And you can get access to those benefits much more quickly than you can now.
Fantastic. Great raft of information and answers from you this morning. Andrea Barton Reeves is CEO of the Connecticut Paid Leave Act. You can go to ctpaidleave.org to learn about the process, the resources, news, and check out some other frequently asked questions that go into quite extreme detail. If you're an employer or an employee, even a sole proprietor or self-employed person that's interested in learning more about the Connecticut Paid Leave Act, we urge you to go to that website. The deadline is approaching December 31st, the launch of Connecticut Paid Leave's program, which will offer Connecticut workers the opportunity to take time to attend to personal and family health needs without worrying about lost income. Andrea, thank you so much. Happy New Year, and best of luck in your position and in ramping up this brand new project that does prove that it will be of great benefit to Connecticut employees. So thanks for your time this morning, and best of luck.
Thank you. And thanks for the opportunity, and happy holidays to you as well.
Well, folks know how we occasionally will talk about hospice on the award-winning For the People here, as well as end-of-life care. It's an issue that it needs to be faced, and it was a stark reminder here as COVID-19 started taking its grip on Connecticut and continues to be problematic for folks. Because a lot of times, due to the restrictions around visitation and around the way the COVID victim is handled, especially if they're transitioned into life-sustaining care, that the decision regarding end of life for that loved one may be rushed or may not get the necessary amount of attention and thought that it might otherwise require. We are pleased to see earlier this month the introduction of the Compassionate Care Act by our Connecticut U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. And to talk about it today, we're going to welcome Kim Callinan. She's president and CEO of Compassion and Choices, which improves care, expands options, and empowers everyone to chart their end-of-life journey. This nonprofit organization works across the nation in communities, state legislatures, Congress, courts, and medical settings, and we'll find out more about them. Kim, thank you for joining us this morning to talk about this really, really important subject and to add a new chapter to our now almost three decades of reporting on end-of-life care. Great to meet you.
Great to meet you as well, and thank you so much for your long-standing commitment to helping ensure that people have the best end-of-life experience possible.
Yeah, so it's pretty exciting. Just the few moments that we chatted before we turned on the microphone, we found out about a kind of a breaking news angle here in that you're not only working with and, of course, supporting the Compassionate Care Act at the federal level, but there is some legislation that Compassion and Choices is also backing and supporting here in Connecticut, in the Connecticut legislature. We'll talk about that as well in just a few minutes. But beyond the brief introduction, Kim, give us a little backstory on Compassion and Choices. Has it been around, this nonprofit, for quite a long time?
Yeah, we have. So Compassion and Choices has been around for about 40 years. And we are committed to ensuring that people have the best end-of-life experience. And we do this in several ways. One is we try to change laws, both at the federal level and the state level. We also try to change the medical system so that it's more patient-directed, similar to the kind of change you saw in the childbirth movement, where it went from a health system that was largely paternalistic to one that was resoundingly patient-driven. And then the last thing that we do is try to make sure that people have the education and the information that they need in order to be a fully empowered consumer. So we don't make a judgment about what choice a person should make at the end of life. What we simply try to do is remove barriers and provide information so people can make the decision that's consistent with their own values and priorities.
It's hard enough and a crushing thing for any individual or family to have to face end-of-life decisions. Kim, if you could talk to us a little bit about what you and your team has been experiencing and as a result suggesting in terms of improvements on a national level, given the onset of COVID-19.
So what COVID-19 has done is it has really highlighted some of the inadequacies in our end-of-life care system. And it has brought to the forefront the importance of planning for the end and ensuring that people are taking the appropriate steps. What we know is that we have some good policies in place as it relates to advanced care planning, but they're far too fragmented. So different states have different policies. Not enough doctors are encouraging their patients to fill out advanced directives, and too few patients have them filled out. If they do have them filled out, they're often not the doctor doesn't have access to them because our medical system is so fragmented, and it's really problematic. You've sure read the stories, and we've heard from patients firsthand whose advance directive was not with them when they were there, and so it left family members and doctors making unconscionable decisions. It leaves healthcare providers in a place of having to make decisions that really are life and death that they shouldn't have to make that, you know, haunt them. It's just, you know, taking the time to plan for the end is so important both for the dying person and for those that are left behind. And what we've seen as a result of COVID is that our policies and our systems are not strong enough.
I can't imagine, although I've had a little bit of experience in having to make end-of-life decisions on behalf of a loved one, I can't imagine a medical professional who is, for whatever reason, detached from any loved ones or immediate family members of a dying patient, and what they have to go through in terms of falling on one side of the line or the other, in terms of the decisions that have to be made. You must hear some nightmare stories about healthcare professionals and the trauma it must put them through.
Yeah, and COVID, I think, in particular, has really, really exacerbated this because it's just happening far too frequently. But you do hear horror stories, and it haunts people. And what's really hard is we know that we have a medical system that is biased. And so people's decision makings, if you don't safeguard your own end of life care preferences, you are also subjecting yourself to whatever your provider bias is. And, that's really unfortunate. It exacerbates the disparities that we see in end of life care. So taking the time to plan for the end and have conversations with your loved ones and your doctors protects yourself. It safeguards yourself to ensure that you get the kind of experience that you want.
Mm. We're also seeing situations across the country and hearing more about where medical teams or even corporate administrators need to make decisions about ensuring that care facilities and ICU beds and units are available for what is perceived as an oncoming crush of COVID patients and having to, make decisions in that arena based on a preemptive need for care. Has this been something that your organization is also looking at?
Yeah, we absolutely have seen that. We have actually developed a COVID-19 toolkit that helps people to think through and plan in advance with their doctor the kind of care that they might want if they were to end up getting COVID. Of course, the you're seeing vast improvements taking place, and so you want to keep that in mind as you're thinking about what you might want. For a lot of people that we know who are terminally ill, already at the very end of their life, they in particular don't want to risk potentially dying alone in a hospital. And so there are options for care in your home instead of being transported to the hospital if you end up getting COVID, if you plan that in advance. And so we're encouraging people to take steps to talk with their doctor about what options might be available to them if they're in that situation.
Mm. And holiday time, although gatherings in person with immediate family members are being discouraged pretty much across the board, there probably is a heightened opportunity at this time of year for family members to not just celebrate the holiday, although they might not be able to be in person, but to also have that challenging discussion with loved ones.
Yeah, it really is a gift to your loved ones. It's the gift of clarity and closure at the end of life. So we do encourage people as you're gathered around the table to have these important conversations, make sure that your advance directives are filled out and take those appropriate steps. It will make a huge difference down the line. For us, we see time and time again the juxtaposition between the family who's had those difficult conversations, whose paperwork is filled out and who's prepared, and those who aren't. And either way, there's a loss and there's grief. So it doesn't take away the loss and the grief of the loved one, but it does make a tremendous difference for those that are left behind in helping to ensure that they're not guilt-ridden, that their decisions are based on what they know their loved one wants. And it makes a huge difference in the long run. I've seen this with my grandmother, whose advance directive was not honored. And we carry around the guilt of knowing that we didn't do a good job protecting and safeguarding what she had actually articulated to us that she wanted. So I encourage people, if you have not taken the steps to find out what your loved ones would want, do it now, because you will regret it if you don't.
Wise words at this midpoint in our conversation with Kim Callinan. She's president and CEO of Compassion and Choices, the nation's largest and oldest end-of-life advocacy organization, with a bold goal that by 2028, half the U.S. population is going to live in a location where medical aid in dying is an open and accessible medical practice. If you want to learn more about the organization, just go to CompassionAndChoices.org, CompassionAndChoices.org. We're going to come back and talk with Kim Callinan a little bit more about Senator Richard Blumenthal's Compassionate Care Act, as well as some pending legislation that's going to hit the statehouse floor this coming year in Connecticut. We'll be right back. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this important news. Griffin Health has expanded its free COVID-19 testing in Connecticut with a new drive-through COVID-19 testing site in Trumbull and expanded hours at its sites in Naugatuck, Farmington, and Middlebury. The new testing site is open at Unity Park on Unity Park Road in Trumbull from 9:30 to 3. The Naugatuck testing site is located at Ion Bank on New Haven Road and is open on Wednesdays, and the farming testing site is at Tunxus Community College and is open on Thursdays. The Middlebury testing site is located at Quasi Amusement Park and is open on Fridays. No appointment is necessary for the Trumbull, Naugatuck, Farmington, and Middlebury testing sites, and all sites will have results available within 24 to 48 hours. A valid ID is required for all testing sites. You can visit griffinhealth.org/COVID for more information. Kim Callanan is with us. Thanks for joining us, or coming back. She is president and CEO of Compassion and Choices, the nation's largest and oldest end-of-life care advocacy organization. So, Kim, I know there's not a huge amount to talk about in terms of what's going to be happening here in Connecticut regarding your advocacy of legislation, but what can you tell us before we switch gears and broaden our focus to Senator Blumenthal's national act?
Absolutely. So you mentioned just before the break that one of our goals is to help ensure that half the population lives in a state where they have access to medical aid and dying legislation by 2028. And our goal is to have Connecticut be among one of those states. So we will be advancing legislation in Connecticut this year that would, if passed, authorize a person who is terminally ill, mentally competent, has a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, so they are at the very end of their life, and is able to take the medication themselves, that they may request from their doctor a prescription that would allow them to end their suffering if they meet those eligibility criteria.
Very good. Well, we'll look for that and hopefully chat with you again or another representative of your organization, as well as state representatives around that legislation as it develops during the 2021 session. We are so happy to see the notice come across our desk earlier this month that U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal from here in Connecticut introduced legislation to promote advanced care planning and end-of-life care to ensure that patients get the care they want and that's right for them. Few Americans, as we heard from Kim, have plans in place or updated plans appropriately authorized in case they become severely ill. And due to the pandemic, more Americans of all ages are now thinking about end-of-life care. And as we have been doing on this program for so long, we don't shy away from talking about it because it does really impact virtually every listener who tunes into our program and to our radio station. So we appreciate Kim Callanan from Compassion and Choices to come on and talk more about it. So Kim, the benefits of the legislation would modernize advanced care planning, expand usage of advanced directives, and extend use of telehealth. Let's focus on the telehealth angle because that has become such a vital link between providers and patients or constituents.
Absolutely. So as a result of the pandemic, the lawmakers passed several provisions that improved end-of-life care as it relates to telehealth, and but those were all done temporarily. Mm-hmm. So what the senator's bill would do is it would remove the originating site fee for telehealth advanced care planning sessions, which decreases the cost incurred by the physician who's hosting the visit and makes physicians much more likely to engage in advanced care planning via telehealth. So it's a little bit of a sort of technical fix, but a really important one that will result in patients being able to get to conduct their advanced care planning conversations via telehealth.
Very good. How about the expand usage of advanced directives?
Yeah, so right now, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of challenges with our advanced care planning because everything is done on a state-by-state level. And there is, so advanced directives are not necessarily honored across state lines, and there's no system for a registry for gathering advanced directives. And so even if someone filled it out, there's no guarantee when they go to that hospital that their advanced directive will be sitting there and looking for it. So what the legislation does is it directs the Secretary of HHS to conduct studies on the feasibility of a national advanced care planning policy that focuses specifically on the portability of end-of-life care directives, so it being able to move across states and even across health systems within a particular state, and then also on the creation of advanced care planning registry so that you can actually find the advanced directive and it would become a part of somebody's electronic health record.
Oh, okay. So this is, you know, we heard so much back when EHRs were introduced so many years ago now. Boy, almost a decade maybe. But now this would tie, if it is deemed appropriate and proper by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and it follows through in terms of testimony and into the bill, it would actually attach these end-of-life directives to the records that any medical professional authorized to do so could access anywhere in the country. So if you're traveling and God forbid something happens while you're in Texas but you're from Connecticut, it could potentially mean that those end-of-life directives would be immediately accessed in the other state?
Yes, that's the end goal. So part of what the legislation does is it authorizes and requires the Secretary of HHS to conduct a feasibility study to basically figure out how do we do that. And it wouldn't just benefit cross-state, but actually the electronic health records aren't really attached within a particular area. So if you go to a hospital that's different from your normal hospital or your doctor has your record, but the doctor's record is not attached to the hospital's. It also looks at how do we create this in such a way where it doesn't matter where a person is, but their advanced directive can be pulled up.
Great. And in regards to modernizing advanced care planning, it looks like a big piece of this is actually, if it passes, getting the awareness communicated to the broadest number of Americans.
Americans and providers, too. So it establishes a national public awareness campaign as about right now, about 30% of the population has an advanced directive, and it's even lower among communities of color. And so the public education campaign would involve the creation of a culturally competent and evidence-based messaging that directs the secretary to pull together a public education campaign, as well as a website for healthcare providers to educate healthcare providers about patients' rights and the importance of developing an end-of-life care plan. And it's important to get the providers involved as well, because they are in a position to be able to encourage all of their patients to have advanced directives on hand. And that will, of course, mitigate a lot of the challenges that we've been talking about.
Mm. And ultimately, the legislation, if successful, would create a national guideline that would hopefully and eventually seat protocols across all the entire spectrum of medical care.
That's exactly right.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to explain all of this to us, as well as to better familiarize our listeners with your organization, Kim. Kim Callanan is president and CEO of Compassion and Choices, the nation's largest and oldest end-of-care life advocacy organization. We're talking about the recently introduced Compassionate Care Act by our own Connecticut U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. If you'd like to learn more about what Compassion and Choices are doing and follow or support the work that they're doing here in Connecticut in the upcoming legislative session. I urge you to visit their website, compassionandchoices.org. That's with an A-N-D, compassionandchoices.org. And Kim, we hope that you have as much better a 2021 as we all deserve. And hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you for your resources and for your energy behind this really, really important initiative.
Thank you so much for having me. And a huge thank you to Senator Richard Blumenthal for championing this legislation.
So as you heard in the introduction, we're going to wrap it up today with a very candid conversation with a very willing guest. David Humphrey is CEO with the ECP-PF Holdings Group Incorporated. As Connecticut continues to navigate this second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, and with threats of statewide shutdowns in surrounding states, there's been recent attention on the potential for stronger restrictions in Connecticut. And a group of Connecticut physicians, actually, you probably saw in the news, recommended to the governor that he close restaurants and gyms as part of the state's COVID-19 mitigation efforts. On the other hand, over in New York, Governor Cuomo announced that gyms are among the lowest drivers of COVID-19 spread of any type of business. And many healthcare professionals around the country agree with this point, stating that fitness and exercise are part of the solution, not the problem, when it comes to combating the risk factors of COVID-19. So we're going to talk with David, which his group oversees 32 Planet Fitness franchises in Connecticut. So David, really, I mean, when we're talking about battling that COVID spread, we're talking about COVID stress. We're talking about the stress of homeschooling. You know, it seems like places to get exercise and work out that that negative energy and just mitigate the potential to, you know, gain weight and become less healthy as we're trying to battle off this greatest health threat the globe has ever known. It just seems so horribly ironic. And your company and the gyms that you operate really seem to inordinately have borne the brunt of it.
You know, I appreciate you saying that, John. It has been a tough year for sure. Irony is exactly the right word. It is ironic that gyms, which are in the health and fitness business, are the business that seems to get focused on, and we would say inappropriately. Let me tell you a little, if I may, about some of the safety measures we've been taking at our Connecticut clubs. Is that appropriate?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, ever since we reopened back in June, we've been following a 98-page playbook of new operating procedures for how we keep our members safe in our clubs. It starts, by the way, with keeping our employees safe. They wear PPE. We check their temperatures before they start work every day. Both our team and our members wear masks at all times in the clubs. Then we shut down many of our cardio and strength machines so our members have plenty of space between them. We call it social fitnessing. Mm-hmm. And when you're at home planning to come in and work out, you can check the crowd meter on the Planet Fitness app to decide the best time to come in. When you arrive, we have a touchless check-in process. All this is different than it would have been 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. Now, you should also remember that each of our clubs is about 20,000 to 25,000 square feet with high ceilings. We use advanced airflow technology to enhance the ventilation, which also makes it easier for members to keep their distance from each other. The sheer size of our clubs makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the cleaning we go through. We do a full deep cleaning every night. Plus, we clean each piece of equipment after each use. We even invested over $2,000 per club to get electrostatic sprayers, which emit a mist of antiviral chemicals. And our members help us. You know, if you think about it, we're one of the very few businesses where our customers are not only making a positive, healthy choice by coming into the business, they're also cleaning up after themselves once they have worked out on a piece of equipment. And then we add an additional layer of cleaning on top of that. You can't say that about many other businesses.
Yeah. And I guess it's important to state at this point, David, that while Planet Fitness is taking the required guidelines as well as your own customized enhancement on those practices, that 98-page playbook is something that all gym and health center operations are bound to follow in Connecticut, right?
Yes, in fact, we nationwide developed a number of the best practices that Connecticut and some other states have adopted. So the industry as a whole is really doing a pretty good job of keeping people as safe as possible. And certainly I can speak for Planet Fitness. We feel incredibly confident, and our numbers prove that.
And I guess what a lot of people may fail to realize is, depending on the facility, it's really the air handling that's a major issue. It's making sure that there's fresh, clean, circulated air happening all the time. But your facilities have essentially always kind of had that in place. So that wasn't something that you had to institute or hardware and practices that you needed to add. But everything else virtually is above and beyond the work that your staffs and facilities have to do, fulfilling all these other items on the punch list, right?
You're absolutely right. No doubt about it. And again, the sheer size of the facilities helps keep people safe. I mean, it's a little different than a little, boutique, you know, like a hot yoga
joint
studio,
yep,
or a boutique. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Gotcha. So I guess then the important question to ask is, across the landscape of all these Planet Fitness facilities that you're operating here in Connecticut, were there any cases of COVID at your gyms, or any cases of spread or contact traced back to your facilities?
Great question. Look, we have 178,000 members in Connecticut, just Planet Fitness. And since we reopened in June, we've had about 1.7 million check-ins among those 178,000 members. And in all of that time, with all of those check-ins from all of those members, we've only had 11 positive cases where a member, after visiting the club, has then contacted the health department or contacted us to say, hey, sometime later, I've learned that I've contracted COVID. Now, they're not saying they got it at the gym. They could have gotten it at the grocery store or
sure,
at church, or who knows where they got it.
Right.
But only 11 out of 1.7 million check-ins, that is a positivity rate of 0.7%.
Right.
And again, there's no evidence that any of those cases were contracted at the clubs. And by the way, that's very consistent with what's been reported around the country. Last week, for example, New York's Governor Cuomo said that gyms are one of the lowest known spreaders of COVID.
And let's shift gears and talk about the bottom line and how it's impacted your business. So how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted your business operations and your bottom line, David?
Well, it's been tough. You know, we had to make a very difficult decision to furlough and lay off some employees back during that first lockdown, which, as you know, lasted about 3 months. But we stayed in touch with our employees, and many of them came back when we reopened in June. But I'm not going to lie to you. If there were a second shutdown, that would be devastating for our employees and for their families.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't be good for us. I mean, for 3 months, we weren't bringing in any revenue. And we had to spend a lot of money on additional cleaning equipment and all the other things we just talked about. But look, we will continue to purchase what we need to purchase, do what we need to do to keep a safe and healthy environment for our members and for our employees. And we do that to show the state that we really should stay open.
Good. And you talked about the 178,000 members in your roles just here in Connecticut. How has the pandemic impacted the attendance of those people?
Well, I am really proud to tell you that we still have 89% as many members today as we had on January 1. And I, to be honest, I take that as a tremendous vote of confidence from our members. They know that we can keep them safe. Now, to your question about attendance, people come in less often on average than they used to, but that's not a very big decline, and we're confident that as people realize how safe Planet Fitness is, they will come back at the same rate they did before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard from medical professionals across the country that it's important for people to utilize exercise for a myriad reasons, even though there was this select group in Connecticut of physicians that suggested bars and gyms just kind of uniformly be closed across the board. Can you talk a little bit about the reasoning for taking the stance in favor of keeping gyms open?
Well, look, it starts with common sense, right? We all know that exercise preserves physical and mental health. And we all see what's going on around us. I mean, since the pandemic started and the lockdowns began, we've all spent too much time on the couch. And there are millions of people living sedentary lifestyles. And we know that's not good. And we've also seen medical studies and research studies pointing to a rise in depression rates. We also have seen the CDC and other scientists talking about how adults who have obesity or diabetes or certain other medical conditions are at an increased risk of becoming severely ill if they do get COVID. And that, I think, the combination of factors is why so many health experts and public officials are now not only realizing that fitness centers and gyms are very safe environments for people, they're actually advocating for us to stay open and keep people active and exercising to combat the virus. You mentioned a small number of doctors in Connecticut that were pushing for gyms and other businesses to shut down. In Chicago, just as an example, the 17,000 doctors in the Chicago Medical Society specifically called for gyms to stay open, even at a time when the city was considering another lockdown. And that's what we want officials in Connecticut and other states to realize, that fitness is part of the healthcare solution to COVID. Yeah. A former Surgeon General of the United States recently wrote an op-ed that appeared in one of the New York papers talking about how gyms are part of the solution, not the problem. There's also just the equity factor to consider, health equity, fitness equity. There's very clear evidence that people from different racial and ethnic minority groups are at an increased risk of getting sick and maybe even dying from COVID. And those people and people generally rely on gyms like Planet Fitness to stay healthy in a way they can afford, right? Our starting membership is $10 a month. And that provides underserved, vulnerable populations an option to stay healthy. As people during the winter are moving indoors, but most normal people can't afford $2,000 Peloton bikes, right, to work out at home. So normal people need to be able to go to the gym.
Yeah, truth be told, they need more than just a bike. The claims far and wide about the biking phenomenon is great, but every exercise physiologist and physician and nutritionist and anyone else surrounding the business says you need a variable workout, the kind of things that a gym like Planet Fitness offers.
You're completely right. And it really is the combination of cardio and strength exercise that's beneficial. Excellent. And specifically beneficial in this environment. You're trying to build a strong immune system. You're trying to boost your lung health. Those are directly helpful to you to reduce the chance of getting coronavirus and reduce the severity of it if you do get it.
To say nothing about reducing the steam on that pressure cooker that is our mental health, I know. And David, we've reached the end of the program this morning, but we're so glad to be able to welcome you on to talk about this as a representative of one of the target industries that was facing possible wholesale closure in the second phase of this coronavirus control situation that Connecticut has been in. We really appreciate it. it. David Humphreys is a CEO of an organization that operates multiple Planet Fitness facilities here in the state of Connecticut, talking candidly about the challenges and the advancements that this organization has been able to affect in order to serve its members and staff and the general public safely. David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.